A poet need have only one enemy, his reputation. And that wasn't a light phrase for Vernon Watkins.
He said, probably, like Blake, my poems will be understood better in 100 or 200 years' time. And that was okay. Reputation was not what he thought of. Writing the poem, getting the poem right, he said, is what I exist for.
Poetic reputations are strange things. A poet can have an enormous reputation in his lifetime, or her lifetime, and after their death it fades away. Vernon Watkins, who died in 1967, was described by Kathleen Raine as the greatest lyric poet of her generation, and whose reputation after his death seems to have faded quite a lot. And yet, for contemporary readers opening his works, what they will find is an immensely sophisticated, deep, emotionally challenging, metaphorically rich work, which deserves close attention, long reading and rereading.
When he died, it was said that he was candidate for Poet Laureate. He had 8 volumes, or even 9, including his translation published by Faber at the time. He'd had the letters from Dylan Thomas published to him. He was a well-known figure. And then he went silent. And when Dylan Thomas died, he became a sort of iconic figure. And Vernon Watkins went silent. It's a mystery.
I think his experiences were very intense. So in some ways, he was very mysterious to me, too. That's why people who like his poems, I think they feel this element of mystery, that he knows something that we don't. And if you read his poems enough, you might get to know it, possibly.
The collected works alone run to more than 500 poems, with more still unpublished. Had he not died unexpectedly at the age of only 61, there would have been many more. In attempting to rekindle an appreciation of Watkins's poetry, I'll be introducing you to some of the key subjects that preoccupied him, illuminated by the thoughts of contemporary poets and writers, including Damien Walford Davis, M. Wynne Thomas, Nigel Jenkins, Richard Ramsbottom, and Gwen Watkins herself.
He was a very, very human being. I really don't know of anybody who could have the depth of connection he had with Yeats, and a brotherly connection with Dylan Thomas, a connection equal to Wordsworth and Coleridge or something. And then Philip Larkin as well. A real depth of friendship.
Well, one thing you can't say about Watkins is that he was a slave to influences from his friends, because so totally different.
And he absolutely
sort of quietly, very obstinately, his own voice.
I that was born in Wales cherish heaven's dust in scales, which may at dusk be seen on every village green, where Towey, Taff or Wye through fields and woods goes by. Or Western Tower's flame writes all its watery name in gold and blinds our eyes.
Watkins had a lifelong attachment to Wales, and in particular to South Gower, the peninsula that sticks out into the Atlantic, culminating in that remarkable headland of Rhosyllia and Worm's Head. This is his native habitat. This is where his essence as a poet belongs. Nigel Jenkins is a contemporary writer and poet from Swansea University. Gower born and bred, he has grown up in the same landscape that fed Watkins's imagination.
I'm standing on the cliffs at Pennard, outside the house that Vernon Watkins and his family lived in, 17, number 17, The Garth. There's a light wind breezing away on the cliffs, lovely sun picking out patches of sea in the distance beyond Oxwich Point, a dark headland sticking out into the sea. And there are crows and brambles, dog walkers, the odd passing car. Generally, it's a wonderfully peaceful, quiet place. There's a man sitting on the cliff's edge, contemplating the sea, very much, I'm sure, as Vernon Watkins himself would have done in his time. He'd just have to walk a few yards from his house, and he'd be standing where I am now, looking at one of the greatest views in the world, really. There's Exmoor and Devon across the way, two ships dotted in the Severn Sea, which some people call the Bristol Channel. Altogether, absolutely captivating mood and atmosphere to the place.
What is it he says in Rhosyllia? My footsole, I know this landscape, you know. My footsole knows it for mine. He did. He knew every rock and cranny. People say, oh, he used to leap up and down the cliffs like a goat. He did. And poor John Heath Stubbs came to stay with us, and I said to Vernon, look, be careful. John's eyesight is not very good. Oh, of course I will, he said. But when John came back, he was spattered with mud. Vernon would jump from rock to rock. I couldn't see where I was going. I just jumped. He just danced down these very rocky, dangerous cliffs like a goat. He was so sure-footed. And strangely enough, because people thought he wasn't very observant, he knew every flower, every bird, every weed, every rock.
The razor shell. I am a long, lean razor shell. Do not interpret me too soon. Streak of the wind with tawny stains, the sky's quill feather marked my grooves. The sea is hidden in my veins. I am a part of all that moves, and more than this, of what remains. There's loving attention to observing the detail of this simple razor shell. The job of a poet is very often to say, don't ignore this. Do not interpret me too soon, as he says in his second line. Pay it attention. It has things to tell us. So this is one of many examples of fine, acute observation, which it takes words beyond words and gives us some aspect of Watkins's vision that I think anybody can identify with. Here on the sand, in burning noon I lie, forgotten by the swell. I hear the breakers and the oars falling along the level shores and beating down the golden grains. Let Solomon consider well and take me cool into his hand. Then ask, before he count the sand, what is that labour to the moon?
I'm fundamentally a religious and metaphysical poet. I'm not a nature poet or a descriptive poet, but of course nature is the great pattern of all one's images. I mean, the truths of nature are really inexhaustible, but what compels one, if one is a metaphysical or religious poet, is the other truth, you see, behind nature.
Vernon Watkins speaking there in a BBC interview late in his life.
Well, I tell you, when my father met him first, when I was going to marry him, he said, my God, he's safe in the arms of Jesus, isn't he? Half of his mind was always with poetry. So he had this slightly loony, a sort of holy fool kind of expression. But he wasn't at all like that. If you saw him playing about poetry, he was never competitive. He was very generous. He loved to see a good poet. But in sport, even with his own children, he was very competitive.
Despite her father's reservations, Gwen would marry Vernon Watkins on the 2nd of October 1944. And among several other published interests, she remains a lively disseminator of his considerable legacy. Her husband's absent-mindedness, as much as his poetic bearing, is legendary. Colleagues at Swansea University still talk of his wearing the key to his office around his neck to avoid losing it, and kneeling on the floor to open the door of his office. But this legendary vagueness didn't extend to his poetry. Watkins is a master technician, one of the most brilliant and distinctive poets of the 20th century. He might read smoothly to some superficial readers, but actually there's a great deal of labour in it.
There's a huge labour.
Richard Ramsbottom is writing a biography of Vernon Watkins at the moment.
He said the first draft has to have a wholeness in it, or you will never have wholeness. But then there's a work and a labour until this second pressure comes. Where the first has died away, actually, and then something comes through.
All of that does raise the question of what he understood by what he thought about the muse, you know, that which takes over what in Welsh you'd call the awen, the breath that comes in.
The demands of the muse were very strict for Vernon Watkins. Let the world offer what it will. Its bargains I refuse. Those it rewards are greedy still. I serve a stricter muse. That's what honed him. That's what made him do hundreds of drafts until it actually came through, a voice that actually has a timeless quality as well.
Walking along the Gower cliffs one day, he hears a lengthy poem, Yeats in Dublin, in less than a second. I've heard even a contemporary writer like Philip Pullman say something of the same thing. the sense that the work is there, you've somehow got to find it to clear away the static and let it come through. But how would the person who knew him best, Gwen Watkins, describe it?
He did have what you have to call a relationship. He called this the muse because he thought she was feminine. He agreed with the old Roman and Greek poets. And he said, you know, it's almost like a telephone conversation, because he said he heard all his poems. He heard them. One poem called Griefs of the Sea, he heard complete. He said that was the only time in his life he ever had a poem come absolutely complete. He just had to write it down.
It is fitting to mourn dead sailors, to crown the sea with some wild wreath of foam on some steep promontory, some corner cliff of Wales, though the deaf wave hear nothing. It is fitting to fling off clothing, to enter the sea with plunge of sea wreaths white, broken by limbs that love the waters, fear the stars, though the blind wave grope and eyes that see, limbs that wonder, though the blind wave grope forward to the sand with a greedy, silvered hand. It is a horrible sound. The low winds whistle across the seaweeds on the beach at night. From stone to stone through hissing caves it passes, up the curved cliff and shakes the prickly thistle and spreads its hatred through the grasses. It seems to be very much of the place. He talked of that poem, of how it came streaming out of the grasses of Pennard Cliffs, as if it's was almost an organic extrusion of the place. And it's got what I like to find in Watkins, and I don't find it everywhere, is that sense of the dark side as well as the light. There's something deeply troubling and troubled about this poem, which appeals to me far more than when he attempts to resolve all contradictions with his lovely rhetoric, which finally, for me, sounds a bit waffly, to be quite honest. This poem has a hard, dark edge. In spite of that wicked sound of the wind that follows us like a scenting hound, it is fitting, on the curved cliff, to remember the drowned, to imagine them clearly, for whom the sea no longer cares, to deny the language of the thistle, to meet their foot-firm tread across the dark-sown tares, who were skillful and erect, magnificent types of godhead, to resist the dogging wind, to accuse the sea-god. Yet in that gesture of anger, we must admit, we were quarrelling with a phantom, unawares. For the sea turns, whose every drop is counted, and the sand turns, whose every grain a holy hourglass holds. And the weeds turn beneath the sea, the sifted life slips free. And the wave turns, surrendering from its folds all things that are not sea. And thrown off is the spirit by the sea, the riderless horse which they once mounted.
The poet Nigel Jenkins reading Griefs of the Sea. Watkins recognised that his obsession with poetry would disqualify him from any very demanding job, and so he opted to work in a bank, because the regular hours allowed him time for his poetry in the evening. With a natural facility for numbers, very useful in pre-decimal days, he was a familiar figure behind the counter of Lloyd's Bank in Swansea. When Philip Larkin visited the Watkins house on the clifftops in Gower, he found a small house, stuffed to the brim with books, five children, wife Gwen, and of course Vernon himself. His life followed a regular pattern. He never learned to drive or owned a car, so he would catch the 8:20 bus into Swansea, returning home to Gwen and the children every evening.
When he came in from the bank, the first thing he did was put the gramophone on. Haydn, Beethoven, Mozart, you know, Elizabeth Schumann's singings. He hated the bank suit and waistcoat and tie and everything. He would change into rough clothes. And then he would have a meal. Usually he would go for a walk, if only to the headland outside the house. It was often 9 o'clock before he would start writing. Always in that valley in Wales, I hear the noise of waters falling. There is a clump of trees we climbed for nuts. High in the trees, the boys, lost in the rookery's cries, would cross and branches cracking under their knees would break and make in the winter wood new gaps. The leaf mould covering the ground was almost black, but speckled and striped were the nuts we threw in our caps, milked from split shells and cups, secret as chestnuts when they are tipped from a sap, glossy and new.
Waterfalls is one of the very few poems in which Watkins recalls his childhood. It shows him at his simplest. It's an account of him playing with the village boys, all of them Welsh speakers, gathering nuts in a valley which lies near his father's old house in Taff's Well on the outskirts of Cardiff.
Rather like Dylan Thomas, who I think at 7 or 8 started writing poetry and was extraordinarily precocious, I also started extremely early without being very precocious. I think my verse remained very derivative until I was 19 or 20. But I certainly started when I was about 7, and by the age of 9, I was collecting all the English poets I could find as presents to my parents. We had some in the house, but I was filling in the gaps, and poetry occupied me continually.
When Watkins tried to fill the gaps on those shelves of his parents, he is certainly likely to have tried to fill them with Blake, with Shelley, with Keats. And Keats, very interestingly, I think, gives him a paradigm for one of his major modes and one of his major interests, the elegy. This is a narrative, of course, of a romantic poet dying young and kick-starting a kind of elegiac tradition in the modern period.
Damien Walford Davis from Aberystwyth University. Indeed, up to the age of about 19, his ambition was to write the kind of poetry that would be, as he put it, numbered among the English poets. In 1955, Watkins recorded a selection of elegiac poetry. Included in it is this touching account of a visit to the graves of some of his poetic heroes, an indication of how much he admired these romantic poets of the past.
In the Protestant cemetery, Rome, where cypress and acacia stand, grave upon grave on either hand, touching the wall's peculiar bell, I hear the new vibration tell, I entered through this very door, violent yet measured years before, to stand in shadow from the sky where Shelley and Trelawney lie, and find the spot where sunlight eats the letters on the grave of Keats. It was a moment when I still knew no remedy for time's ill, among the many or the few, no power effective to renew, substance loved and treasured most, seeming irreparably lost. Watching those animated trees move above the contraries, writing shadows on the dead, lifting the shades their dying shed, I, like one who was gagged and bound, having no words but in the ground, defying time and memory, sought to resolve their tragedy.
You can see from the list of his poems to and about other poets how much he felt he owed them, in particular Yeats, a lifelong influence on his poetry, and Dylan Thomas. We've seen already how Gower and the inheritance of the romantic poetry of the past recur in Watkins' poetry. But turning to one of his best-known early poems, The Ballad of the Murray Lloyd, we can find a theme that Watkins embraces in all of his poetry, the threshold between death and life. The Murray Lloyd, knocking on the door with her drunken, anarchic companions, is the insistent presence of the dead, who are hungry and thirsty. They're demanding to cross the threshold and be fed by the living. Watkins is at his most musical and compelling in this brilliant piece of poetic drama, as fascinating to M. Wynne Thomas and Damien Walford Davis as it is to me.
It conjures up the presence of these invasive ghosts, almost, of course, as if they were also ghosts from the depths of Watkins' own unconscious. Out in the night, the nightmares ride, and the nightmares' hooves draw near. Dead men pummel the panes outside, and the living quake with fear. Quietness stretches the pendulum's chain to the limit where terrors start, where the dead and the living find again. They beat with the self-same heart.
You wonder, at the end of every page, can he get any more intense? this recurrent midnight, 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 hark at the hands of the clock. Go back with your drowned and drunken eyes and your crooked mouth so small, and your Mari, fold of the starry skies, go back to the sea waves fall. If we lift and slide the bolt in the door, what can our warm beer buy? What can you give for the food we store but a slice of starving sky? Sinner and saint, a horse's head in the frost. And the climax, the intensity, which builds and builds and builds, right up to the very last moment where you finally go back to midnight, 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 midnight.
One of the great attractions of it is that uncanniness, that inability to pigeonhole the Mary Lloyd. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it a murderous mare brought by devils, he says, or is it a more benedictory presence coming to knock at that strange time of year when the old year is dying and the new year is about to be born?
A passage which moves me greatly from another of the ballads, the Ballad of the Outer Dark, which is rather late in his work, where, as in the Ballad of the Mary Lloyd earlier on, he's writing about the New Year ceremonies in traditional Wales, the carrying of the mare's skull from house to house with singing and dancing, and the very odd collection of associations around New Year's Eve in Celtic folklore, and especially in South Wales, where it's a time when the dead and the living mingle, where the boundaries are down. So he has the fifth voice in the Ballad of the Outer Dark. I that am bone, let me remember centuries gone this December. A circle smaller lit by flame, known to the caller each by name, climbing the turret in death-like weather, I, a spirit, hold them together. Embers falling as now they fall, all I remember, all, all. And it's that all at the end which is again metrically wonderful and emotionally absolutely loaded with significance. We've seen how nature, Celtic mythology, death and life, and the poetic heroes of the past feed into Watkins's poetic imagination. But one single event precipitated much of Watkins's outlook.
I know a truth no volumes can explain. Man is transformed since priceless treasure drew his dreaming will, the products of whose brain break his intention and return more true. That's about his vision at 20. You see, it remained so deep in his heart. It was the mainspring of his life, I think.
I know a truth no volumes can explain. Man is transformed. In Richard Ramsbottom's opinion, it was something of a near-death experience, the result of which was a complete transformation in his view of poetry.
It could initially be seen as a breakdown, but it was much more a breakthrough, and it changed everything. He described it as the pivotal moment of his life. He destroyed almost everything he'd written before. And after that, he said the only significant thing was that poetry would be valid. People read it, whatever, was not important. The only important thing is that it is valid.
What happened at the end of it was this healing, religious, not exactly a vision, but he said, I know that Christ is the Redeemer and the Saviour. And in his 60s, not long before he died, I've got a little piece of paper on which he's written, I've been shown a true thing. Why should I have to defend it? I don't need to. So it was the great thing, the turning point of his life.
I'm standing in the graveyard of Pennard Church, a pretty little 14th century church in the corner of what used to be my family's farm. My home is just a few fields away. And those of us who did come to church would come to this church, not usually regularly on Sundays, but perhaps at Christmas, perhaps at Easter. But Vernon Watkins was, of course, a sincere and committed Christian, and he used to come here. This is a lovely little church. It's intimate, small. It feels old. Stained glass with sunlight flowing through and shedding reflections on the windowsills. And in the corner of the church is a plaque in marble to Vernon Watkins. It says, Vernon Watkins, poet, 1906-1967, and it quotes from his work, "Death cannot steal the light which love has kindled, nor the years change it." And love certainly was an important word for him. Love often in the guise of charity, in the old-fashioned understanding of the word. So it's fitting, I suppose, that the word should be highlighted in this memorial plaque.
We've talked a bit about the moment of spiritual transformation that Watkins undergoes. He's certainly a religious poet in the sense that you can't begin to understand him without understanding how seriously he took the transcendent. But was he conventionally a believer? Or was he someone who knew his way in and out of the language and habits of religion without quite wanting to pin down what his views were about them? Damien Walford Davis.
He's certainly a poet fascinated by ritual and ceremony, those of the natural world as well as those of man and those of organised religion. What other words are there? Christological, a big word, but it's certainly there in the sense that he constantly references Christ quite explicitly in a number of poems from the 40s right through to his death in 67 and in the posthumous poems as well. And he's very good at locating those moments in rather ordinary contexts as well. There's an accessibility there as well. He's not talking always about Christianity on a grand stage. He is drawing it into a relation with our ordinary lives.
In the poem "For a Christening," which I think is one of the great Christian statements he makes, you'll find, "Even as he fell with Sabachthani cries to those 3 days in hell, so must your eyes close for 3 seconds now to be made well." And on "So raised, learn this, to admire a paradox is not enough. It is lightning that rocks the shroud itself, if our own loss we kiss." If our own loss we kiss, that's the beginning of the Christian life. Baptism, that's what the Christian life is about. Christianity, I think, for him is one of those things that actually breaks the language open rather than closing it down.
He is a Christian Platonist poet.
M. Wyn Thomas from the University of Wales, Swansea.
There's a tradition of that. He was concerned with that central vision, Christ as the incarnation of the eternal. And I think that was important to him. That's how I would see him anyway. And he thought that there were foreshadowings of the Christian message in ancient mythology, for example, or in Celtic mythology. And I think the figure of Christ is, in his mind, connected with a figure such as Taliesin.
Taliesin, as a historical 6th century Welsh poet, becomes, if you like, for Watkins, a fantastic model for the poet himself, living himself into different forms, both poetic forms, and Watkins is a master of giving you a sonnet, then an ode, then a ballad. So there's that Taliesinic idea in the very forms that Watkins chooses to throw himself into. So we can usefully think about the whole of Watkins's career as in some way modelled on that poet Taliesin in the Welsh tradition. A poem like Taliesin in Gower brings that magical, mysterious poet to the beaches and to the seas of the Gower Peninsula, his beloved Gower Peninsula, proving that this is a mythical poet who is also profoundly modern.
Taliesin is an intermediary between that world, which is the world of the timeless, and this world, which is the world of time. Watkins is fascinated by his sensation of having a kind of a sacramental glimpse of this other world beyond time. Bright shoots of everlastingness keep breaking out into his sight as man and as poet. There is the famous suite of poems on the subject music of colours, and there's one called Dragonfoil and the Furnace of Colours, and it talks about the white light and then the colours that eventually result from it that you and I and all of us see. Dragonfly, kingfisher, breaking from the white bones. Snows never seen, nor blackthorn boughs in winter. Lit by what brand of a perpetual summer, these and the field flowers. He can write beautifully like that. And what you notice there, of course, is what he understood poetry to be. It was a means whereby we were transported from a mundane world so that we began to see that world as transfigured into a remarkable spiritual vision.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that his close friendship with his fellow townsman Dylan Thomas has turned Watkins into Swansea's other poet. But there's little apart from geography and personal acquaintance that they have in common. Dylan Thomas moulds his poems in very particular ways, often visual ways. Watkins works from the ear and for the ear. His poems are always intrinsically musical. Watkins was 8 years older than Thomas. They first met in Swansea in 1935. Gwen Watkins has vivid memories of Thomas, whom Watkins always acknowledged as a genius. As well as meeting up with Thomas privately, Watkins was absorbed into an eclectic group of Thomas's friends, all artists, writers and musicians. Meeting with Dylan Thomas and with Alfred Janes and others in the Cardoma Cafe in Swansea, where I remember going as a schoolboy myself, not in the same era, that feeling that he is both very deeply embedded in other people's imaginations and other people's creativity, and also remarkably independent, remarkably sort of insouciant about all that. Dylan Thomas is manifestly, both humanly and imaginatively, a real presence in Watkins's world. How did that begin, and how did they think about it, the two of them?
One day, coming back from the bank, he saw a copy of Dylan Thomas's first book of poetry and was led to read it and said he didn't really have space for another major figure in his life. But of course he read it and he met Dylan and he said, and made space. And this incredible friendship began.
Dylan used to come out and go for walks with Vernon along the cliff, because Vernon was very active, you know. He loved games, he loved walking. He used to bathe almost through the winter. And when he'd go down to bathe in October, Dylan would stay at the top of the cliffs and throw stones down and wait for the people underneath to scream, you know.
They tussled and shared everything, and maybe not every poem, but so many and words. And it's a great pity that Watkins's letters are lost. We have Dylan Thomas's. But you see them passing lines to and fro, and no, this, that, and what about this, and no, that's one of your lines. And so on a level of two utterly devoted poets working together, it was very significant, I think.
The surviving letters that Richard Ramsbottom mentions show that initially the association was beneficial to both poets. But although Thomas proved over time to be a valued judge and critic of Watkins's work, there's some debate as to how much use Thomas had for Watkins in the same capacity.
In one of his letters, Dylan Thomas makes a devastating remark that seems to me to put a finger on a weakness in Watkins's writing. He says of Watkins's poems, they seem to come out of the nostalgia of literature. Well, what did he mean by nostalgia of literature? What I understand him to mean is that Watkins yearned to write poems in the manner of the great poets of the past. And Thomas, of course, who was nothing if not a radical, a maverick original, had really no time for that.
In 1941, Vernon Watkins was called up for service. First of all, as an RAF policeman, a posting for which he turned out to be too mild-mannered to be effective, and then with RAF intelligence at Bletchley Park in 1943. Though, as Gwen Watkins recalls, he didn't quite live up to expectations there either.
He had this cut-glass accent. He'd been to an English prep school. He'd been to Repton. He'd been to Cambridge. He was officer material, but he failed. And he said, well, I don't know. I think it may have been because in my drill exam, I marched a squad into a wall, you see. I was thinking about something, and I forgot to say, halt. And the fools went on, and they all piled up into a wall, you know, laughing. And he said, also, I forgot to take my rifle on the passing out parade. So anyway, he failed. But he didn't care. He said, you get much better table tennis in the sergeant's mess. So I'm glad I failed.
During the war years, Vernon Watkins and Dylan Thomas would meet up in London from time to time. On one memorable occasion, they spent a night sheltering together under a table during an air raid. On the 2nd of October 1944, Thomas was due to be best man at Watkins's wedding. The couple waited in vain at the Church of St. Bartholomew the Great in the city. Inexplicably, Thomas failed to turn up, much to Watkins's annoyance.
Vernon was absolutely outraged. He said, "Right, that's it. Either he's paralysed from the neck down or dead. Otherwise, there's no excuse I'll accept." But of course he did. You don't think this because Dylan was so often slightly drunk and very uproarious in company, but he was pretty shy, and I don't think he wanted to meet my parents or Vernon's sisters or anything. He says he got in a taxi and couldn't remember the name of the church. But he wasn't supposed to come to the church. He was supposed to come to the Charing Cross Hotel to have lunch. But I think he may have just, you know, chickened out.
But Watkins's deep sense of loyalty prevailed, and he forgave his friend. There's really no question as to how large this relationship with Dylan Thomas loomed in Watkins's life. After Thomas's death in 1953, he wrote many wonderful poems of tribute. In the aftermath of his breakdown, Watkins had stated he was no longer interested in whether a poem would be remembered. Taking that idea a step further, he even decided that his poetry should not be published. But 8 years later, he would change his mind. T.S. Eliot was the preeminent literary figure of the day, and for Watkins, a gateway to wider recognition. After advice from Eliot, Watkins' first book of poetry, The Ballad of the Moray Lloyd, was published by Faber in 1941. It was the beginning of an important association between Watkins and Faber, and several more collections of poetry followed. Part of the T.S. Eliot archive is being prepared for publication, so it was good to welcome Ian Smith from Kingston University, a scholar in the study of T.S. Eliot, to Lambeth Palace, along with a representative of Eliot's estate, to look through some unpublished correspondence between Watkins and Eliot.
In 1937, Watkins writes to Eliot submitting poetry, and Eliot is sympathetic to a young, fluent, immensely talented Christian writer. At the same time, Eliot says you must be published elsewhere first, effectively saying that Faber is the Premier League and a poet must build a reputation in order to be promoted into that league. Eliot was always a pragmatic and thinking businessman as a publisher, as well as a Christian and poet.
In November 1942, Watkins is writing to Eliot as Corporal Watkins, the RAF, not insignificant as a bit of background, and says something very, very significant about what he thinks he's about as a poet. He writes, "I should have told you two that the sonnets will be coming out probably in the next number of poetry, not in the one which recently appeared." So he's taking Eliot's advice about creating a public among readers of periodicals. Mm-hmm. Then he goes on, "I know just what kind of poetry I want to write, and that is more important than the accident of its achievement. If I imitate others, I write feebly and weakly, but I find the work is always most vigorous when I submit to the theme which dominates me and doesn't appear to concern others. For this reason, I don't want to publish another book for 5 years at least. It is a pity that the elements which are most sympathetic to poetry remain the furthest from its essence, and that they tend to throw a net of rivalry and ambition over what is really a gift to the dead."
I think Eliot loved Watkins because Watkins was so fluent and wrote about the same kind of things that Eliot did, but could produce material. And this gave Watkins something that every poet in English would have killed for, which was Eliot begging him to write poetry. And then Watkins, with a commercial acumen, not perhaps that of a man with a lifetime in banking, says, "No, I don't want to publish just yet."
For some people, Watkins is a powerful witness of the wartime years. The poet David Wright, who knew him, said he was one of the very few who have the moral ability to scan the lineaments of our present predicament without turning into a stone or rattling like a pebble. On one period of leave from the Air Force in 1944, Watkins wrote a poem which uses the symbol of a seagull's fallen feather to write about what had been lost. It's a poem that shows Watkins at the height of his poetic powers.
In a poem called A Feather, you get from the beginning a sense of his particular sensitivity to the brokenness of our temporal existence, his sympathy for the damaged, as I suppose in a sense, from that point of view, we all are. And it's imaged in his beachcombing experience of coming across a seabird's feather. "I stooped to gather a seabird's feather, fallen on the beach, torn from a beautiful drifting wing. What can I learn or teach, running my finger through the comb and along the horny quill? The body it was torn from gave out a cry so shrill, sailors looked from their white road to see what help was there. That sense of a cry from a torn from a body, that is also one aspect of himself as poet at his best. I think there is that cry of underlying anguish in some of his very best poetry, such as the Ballad of the Mary Lwyd and such as this poem, The Feather. And it's also about the experience of a creature fallen, so to speak, from eternity into time. Sheer from wide air to the wilderness, the victim fell and lay. The star-like bone is fathomless, lost among wind and spray. This lonely, isolated thing trembles amid their sound.
Watkins's meshing of his own poetry with the myth of Taliesin betrays the importance of both transfiguration and the sense of the other, the world beyond time. And of course it reconnects him with his Celtic heritage, not least through the landscape of Gower itself. These things combined with his tremendous facility with words and metre, and his deep Christian faith, make him a compelling voice in 20th century poetry. We're still capable, perhaps more than ever, of appreciating the metaphysical world of John Donne or George Herbert. We know we don't have to be afraid of complexity. We don't even have to be afraid of music in poetry. Watkins can still speak and move us deeply, doing what poetry does, making the world very strange, quite new, and wonderful.
The Guest. All day, all night, wind and wild rain had blown. Then the gale dropped, and in September weather, where sunlight lingered on the pulse of stone, red thistle and wild harebell shone together. The cliff's crossed paths lay silvered with slug tracks, where webs of hanging raindrops caught the sun. A thrush with snail cocked sideways like an axe, knocked with quick beak to crack it on a stone. Stumbling, a blue-black beetle groped its way where crickets perched and dropped like jewellery. Dawn's pestle mixed fresh colours for the day, and far beneath, a cormorant crossed the sea. There was no guest to watch the landscape change. All day, slow, silken threads, gold spiders spun. Towards evening, then, I broke them, seeing a strange fleece in low heather catch the western sun. There, halfway down the cliff, in fallen flight, I came on plumage, tufted claws, wide wings, a white owl dead, feeding fritillary light into those roots from which the heather springs. No wound appeared, though death had shrunk the eyes. The bright wings held no markings but their own. How close it lay, no mouse dared recognize, lest it should pounce and tear it to the bone.